From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
Some call it political payback. Senator Mike Fasano speaks out against being removed from his committee chairmanship.
No matter how big the bully in the schoolyard may be, if the loss of a chairmanship is the result of taking a stand for what I believe is right, I wear that loss as a badge of honor.
A federal appeals court sides with citizens who demanded an end to political gerrymandering.
In our Constitution, the very first line in it is that political power rests with the people. And it does, and this court made that argument loud and clear.
A bill in the House would give the governor more ways to remove other public officials from their posts. And we hear debate on a bill that increases the penalties for those dealing with child pornography. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. Today, Republican Senator Mike Fasano of Newport Richey was removed from his chairmanship on the Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Appropriations Committee by Senate President Mike Haradopoulos. Political insiders agree it was all because Fasano was against efforts to privatize Florida's prison system, a priority of legislative leadership. I decided to give Fasano a call to find out what really happened.
Please go right ahead, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for taking time to speak with me here on Capitol Report. As you know, our show is always keeping people informed with what's happening in our state capitol. Now, I understand there's big news with you today. You were removed from your committee.
Yes, I was removed by President Haradopoulos from the chairmanship of the Criminal Justice and Civil Justice Appropriations Committee. I feel confident that the reason why I was removed was because I would not go along with his proposal to privatize state prisons across the state of Florida.
Now, you've been very vocal. You haven't kept it secret that you're opposed to the state's efforts to privatize the prison system. So was this expected, or are you still shocked by the removal today?
I was quite surprised. I always believe that we come to Tallahassee to vote our conscience. I've always prided myself to stick up for the little guy and gal throughout the state, those who otherwise would not have a voice in the legislative process. And I'm a big believer that we speak out when we see injustice. And no matter what the consequences may be, I never thought by opposing, in my opinion, a very bad policy by turning over $500 million worth of private prisons that were paid for by the taxpayers over to private companies would force me out of a chairmanship. A bit disappointed that's the punishment, if you will, that President Haradopoulos and the leadership of Tallahassee gives out when you oppose something that they support.
How long have you been chairing this committee?
I've been chairing it now for going on 2 years. Started last year in the first session. This would be the second session. I've been in the legislature for 18 years, but in my 18 years as an elected office holder in Tallahassee from the Tampa Bay area, I've never seen this happen to a member that opposed something that the president and the leadership was supporting. This is a policy issue, and I just respectfully disagreed that this is not the direction that we should be going. I also believe because they did not have the votes, the leadership and President Haradopoulos did not have the votes to move forward on this issue, is probably one of the other reasons why I was removed as chairman, because I was one of those that stood in the way of, along with other Republicans and Democrats, stood in the way of this bill that was being pushed, with lightning speed through the Senate.
Essentially, you were in the way.
I guess so. But this is what I told a friend today as I was speaking to her earlier. I said, no matter how big the bully in the schoolyard may be, if the loss of a chairmanship is the result of taking a stand for what I believe is right, I wear that loss as a badge of honor, and it's just kind of sad that when the leadership and the special interests, the private companies that want to privatize prisons can't get their way in Tallahassee, and they lose, they can't lose like gentlemen, and it's a bit disappointing. It should be disappointing to every taxpayer, every citizen throughout the state of Florida.
Now, what's next? Who do you think will be your replacement as chairman of that committee? And will you still be on that committee, just not as chairman?
No, I've been removed from the committee completely. I've also been removed from the budget committee as well, so I will not be able to voice my opposition to anything that will hurt the little guy and gal in those committees. However, I'll be ready for any issue and any policy change that would have an ill effect on the taxpayers and the small businessmen and women and really the little guy and gal throughout the state. I'll be ready on the Senate floor to oppose it and speak out against it, as I have on this issue. I can only suggest, you know, as the final days of the president's tenure come to a close, President Haridopoulos, I would encourage him, not only him, but his leadership team, to stand up for the little guy and gal, the taxpayers, the consumers of the state, to make certain that they're protected, and not the special interest groups. The special interest groups should not prevail in Tallahassee, and unfortunately, that may happen if we don't speak out against what's going on up here.
All right. Well, Senator Mike Fasano, thank you very much for taking this time to speak with me.
God bless you. Have a great day.
In his afternoon media availability following the Senate session, Senate President Mike Haridopoulos said he has respect for Senator Fasano, but feels the senator was not ready to make the difficult cuts needed to balance the budget without raising taxes.
I've known Senator Fasano for 13 years. We are friends. But as president of the Senate, I have an absolute responsibility to make sure that we pass a balanced budget and we do it in the most effective way possible. And I just felt I had lost confidence in him to fulfill that mission. As you take a chairmanship, as you all know from the Florida Senate, it's part of it is to fulfill the mission of the goals of balancing the budget and making tough decisions.
Senate President Mike Haridopoulos. Yesterday, a federal appeals court rejected a challenge to Florida's Amendment 6. It's one of the Fair Districts Amendments added to the Constitution by voters to curb gerrymandering. A 3-judge panel rebuffed efforts by U.S. Representatives Mario Diaz-Balart and Corinne Brown to throw out the guidelines for drawing legislative and congressional districts. James Call reports the ruling was handed down 2 days before the Florida House is scheduled to debate new political maps for the fall election.
Diaz-Balart, a Miami Republican, and Brown, a Jacksonville Democrat, opposed the Fair Districts Amendment from the very beginning. The two benefited from a plan hatched by Republicans and African-American Democrats in 1992 to draw minority-access districts. Here's Diaz-Balart speaking against the amendments, one for Congress, the other for the State House, in 2010, before voters approved them.
These are the bleaching amendments. These amendments will have the effect of bleaching the state of Florida as it was before 1992, when minorities did not have the ability to elect candidates of their choice. That's what it's all about here. It's unworkable, and it will have a devastating effect on minorities across the entire state of Florida.
That was the opening shot against Amendment 6, which applies to congressional seats. The voters didn't agree with Diaz-Balart's protest and approved the amendment with 62% of the vote. By the time the dispute landed before the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the opponents' arguments were reduced to the power to change congressional redistricting rules resides solely with the legislature and not the voters through a referendum. Dan Gelber is the general counsel for Fair Districts and says the 3-judge panel took 32 pages to explain why that sentence is at odds with American tradition and law.
The court obviously dismissed their arguments out of hand by saying that it's precisely the power of the people to create criteria that would guide its legislature in its creation of districts. All the Fair Districts Amendments do is give a criteria by which that the legislature has to follow. It's perfectly appropriate. And any other interpretation would mean that the legislature is more important than the people. In our Constitution, the very first line in it is that the political power rests with the people. And it does, and this court made that argument loud and clear.
The Fair District Amendments, number 6 for Congress and Amendment 5 for the state legislature, require that the districts be compact rather than sprawling, that they not favor a candidate or party, or shut racial or language minorities out of the political process. By rejecting the challenge, Gelbert suggests that the court also sent a clear message to the Florida House of Representatives. It is helping pay for lawsuits challenging the voter-approved amendments. Gelbert says there should be no further appeals.
So now it's time, because of these amendments and because of what the people said they wanted, to quit trying to prevent them from being implemented and to follow them and to follow the rule of law in our Constitution.
That is exactly what the House's Redistricting Committee chairman says his committee did. Wesley Chapel Representative Will Weatherford is leading the House in drawing new political districts. After the committee approved the new maps, Weatherford said there has never been a more fair drawing of state House and congressional districts in history that he knows of.
Based on newspaper articles I've read by your very newspapers, almost a third of the legislators in our chamber are drawn out of their seats. There's not a single legislature in the history of America that I know without a court order that has drawn that many members out of their seats. We did it because that's what the Constitution said we had to do. There was no politics involved. This was purely something that we felt like we had to do to follow the Constitution.
However, the House has set aside time on both Thursday and Friday to debate the proposed maps for Florida's 27 congressional seats, 40 state Senate seats, and 120 state representative seats. Fort Lauderdale Representative Evan Jenny is the ranking Democrat on the House's redistricting committee. He and other Democrats cast a series of no votes in committee with little comment. He says he has been around the process long enough to know when he will get a straight answer.
There's two things that make Tallahassee go round. One is money and the other is partisanship. And this is 100% partisanship. It's a partisan thing that we're dealing with. And we thought that there were maps that could have been done a little bit better. We felt like there were some things that could have been better within them. And we just didn't see them present. So
Jenny didn't finish the thought, but suggested that reporters wait until the redistricting bill comes up on the House floor. Speaker Dean Cannon says he wants to make sure there's appropriate and ample debate of the maps. The House is scheduled to be in session 15 hours Thursday and Friday, and a vote on all three maps is expected to be taken by the end of Friday. Speaker Cannon.
I've set aside time on Thursday and Friday because I expect to be on the floor on Thursday and Friday. We want to make sure that there's appropriate and ample debate. And we're a larger chamber than the Senate, so I don't know what their expectations are, but mine are not to do anything extraordinary to rush things along. We will neither, again, accelerate them nor delay them. But I wouldn't have allowed time on the floor on Friday if I'd expect us to be on the floor on Friday. We'll see how long it takes and kind of handle it in the due course of things.
Once the House approves the new maps, it will send them to the Senate. And after the Senate passes the proposals, the Florida Supreme Court will have 30 days to approve them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a bill in the House would add one more line to a list of reasons that would let the governor remove public officials from their posts.
Misfeasance, neglect of duty, drunkenness, incompetence, permanent ability to perform duties, commission of a felony, habitual drunkenness.
A bill to regulate what people on welfare can and can't eat backfires on its sponsor.
I just don't think it's right for us as legislators and as a government to tell anyone what they can eat, even if they happen to be poor.
And a sponsor of a bill says he's not sure why there are so many concerns over a bill that puts more penalties to stop child pornographers.
Child pornographers use technology so that they can have thousands of victims, but only one charge. If we stand by up here and we allow that, I don't know how I go home and see my two kids.
Florida lawmakers are considering a bill aimed at local governments that have been declared to be in a state of financial emergency. The bill would let the governor boot local government leaders who fail to fix the situation. The measure passed the Senate, but Regan McCarthy reports it's having difficulty in the House.
Representative Dorothy Hugel, a Port Orange Republican, says House Bill 7031 is aimed at keeping local governments and other entities like school districts solvent. Hugel says there are certain indicators that a local government is in financial distress. When those show up, local governments have to let the governor know, and school districts have to notify the Commissioner of Education.
And at that point, current law provides that a state of financial emergency is declared, and then there is certain help that is available, including money, financial help, and certain types of procedural help.
Hugel says her measure focuses on what would happen after a state of emergency is declared. Her proposal would implement two recommendations made by the state's Auditor General in 2011. First, Hugel says her bill would put a time frame in place for how quickly an entity that's been declared to be in a state of financial emergency must give financial information to the state government so it can help.
If the entity reports to the governor that they've met one of these statutory indicators, the governor's office will ask for certain information, but there's nothing in current law that would provide when that has to be provided.
Representative Debbie Mayfield, a Vero Beach Republican, says she knows from serving as chairman of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that a rule like this is sorely needed. She says when the government is trying to take a look at how taxpayer dollars are being spent, there should be some sense of urgency that would result in a timely response.
A couple of months ago, what we ended up having to do, because we did have problems with that, was send letters to the delegation chair members to let them know that we needed their help in getting financial statements in.
The second part of the bill is more controversial. Huckel says the measure would give the governor the power to remove an official who fails to fix the financial problem. She says the Constitution already gives the governor the authority to do that in several situations.
Basically, what the Constitution says is malfeasance, misfeasance, neglect of duty, drunkenness, incompetence, permanent ability to perform duties, commission of a felony, etc. Statutory reference in statute 112.51 reiterates those, but also includes, believe it or not, and this is a very old statute, also includes habitual drunkenness.
Huckel says her proposal would clarify that failing to fix a financial state of emergency would count as a reason for the governor to be allowed to remove someone from his or her position. But Representative Dwayne Taylor, a Daytona Beach Democrat, says he doesn't like the idea of giving the governor that power.
There are other mechanisms and other ways that you can get this information without allowing the governor the ability to remove commissioners for things that are really subjective. If you look at the items that are outlined, the inability to perform is basically a subjective. That's based on somebody's interpretation.
Taylor says other reasons the governor would have for removing an elected official are based in fact.
When a commissioner is arrested, there's no doubt that that commissioner was arrested. So you can pretty much remove them.
Representative Jeff Clemens, a Democrat from Lake Worth, has similar concerns.
We can already remove council members for malfeasance. If there's something obvious that they've done, we can remove them. But I think this opens it up to being able to remove members for political reasons because of the generality of the definition of the inability to cure whatever financial ills the city has.
Others worry the proposal could unfairly punish officials who've inherited the situation. Huckel says a law that has allowed the governor to remove officials has existed since the 1960s. She says the measure targets those who refuse to take the steps needed to solve a financial emergency, which she points out is not a designation given lightly. The measure passed through the House State Affairs Committee in a close 9-6 vote. It now moves to the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. A proposal limiting when, for what, and where the state's food and cash assistance benefits, also known as welfare, can be used, has passed a House committee. Lena Hatter reports the move comes after a report on the misuse of the Electronics Benefits Card, or EBT.
The program provides food and financial assistance to low-income people. It used to be that the food benefit came in a paper format known as food stamps. But years ago, the program transitioned to a credit card-like delivery system. That card can also carry the financial benefit, called temporary assistance for needy families. It's normally used to pay things like housing, utilities, clothing, or other incidentals not covered under the food benefit. But according to Republican Representative Scott Plakin of Longwood, sometimes that cash benefit is used in places it shouldn't be.
These EBT cash assistance cards were being used at a lot of different places that perhaps taxpayers weren't aware. Strip clubs and gambling locations, down in Miami at a $3,300 at a liquor store, for example. He also found they're being used out of state.
Plakin says his inspiration for the bill came from a news report in Fort Myers, but not everyone agrees the problems are widespread. Here's Representative Lori Berman, a Delray Beach Democrat, questioning the intent of the bill.
Would you be surprised to learn that the results of the NBC2 reporter was that it was only 0.03% of total transactions?
Plakin says he wants to ban the card's use in places like liquor stores and internet cafes, but the language of the bill is so broad that some lawmakers say the ban could affect regular grocery and convenience stores like a Walgreens or a CVS. And Fila Cueva with the food aid group Florida Impact says in some areas of the state, the local convenience store also doubles as the main grocery store.
Particularly in low-income neighborhoods and folks with limited transportation, these folks have no access to larger grocery stores, and so basically they purchase their goods and services in local retail stores, convenience stores, and most of those don't carry sort of fresh food, nutritious items.
In addition to where the card can be used, Representative Plakin's bill also outlines what foods can and can't be purchased. The measure blocks the food assistance money from being used for sodas, cupcakes, even Jell-O or chocolate milk. For Republican Representative Dana Young of Tampa, that just goes too far.
I don't want people to tell me what to eat. And I just don't think it's right for us as legislators and as a government to tell anyone what they can eat, even if they happen to be poor.
And Democrats like Representative Gwendolyn Clark Reed are certainly not impressed with the bill.
So I find this this bill really, in a way, it's discriminatory, and it's aimed at low-income families who are on food stamps.
Plakin acknowledges the measure does have its flaws, but disagrees that the proposal is an overreach of government.
Because I don't want to lose the whole bill over parts that are more controversial than the rest. The motivation, in addition to it start with the internet cafes, and I'll be brief, but I have noticed, if you look at stores members, EBT, companies are advertising, it's big business.
The measure narrowly cleared the House committee with an 8-6 vote. It will likely be amended to remove some of the food ban language at its next two committee stops. A similar effort by Senator Rhonda Storms is moving in that chamber. It's headed to its last committee stop in the Senate Budget Subcommittee on Health and Human Services Appropriations. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Finally, a bill aiming to crack down on child pornographers is now heading to the House floor. But as Sasha Cordner reports, there was much debate at its last committee stop that even surprised the bill's sponsor.
Video voyeurism is the practice of spying on someone engaged in a number of things ranging from undressing to sexual activity. Republican Representative Eric Eisnagel of Orlando says his bill would crack down on the activity.
Over the summer, I had a constituent call my office, a father of a 12-year-old girl who'd been victimized by someone who committed video voyeurism against his 12-year-old daughter. He was very upset because he had just found out that even though this guy admitted to committing video voyeurism against his 12-year-old daughter at a local Walmart and pleaded guilty, that he wasn't going to have to register as a sex offender, and so started working on this bill.
House Bill 437 would make it a second-degree felony if someone commits video voyeurism against a minor and require that anyone who commits video voyeurism against a child register as a sex offender. Under current law, someone who is charged with video voyeurism would only be charged for the video, not the number of victims depicted in the video. Eisnagel's bill would allow prosecutors to charge someone for every victim depicted in a video. But Gail Coletta disagrees with the amount of penalties Eisnagel is putting in place. She's the president of Florida Action Committee, a group that seeks to make the public more aware about myths versus facts regarding sex offender issues.
I'm also the mom of a young man who got caught up in all of this while he was in a manic phase of a bipolar event. The prosecutors are not separating out those that pose a threat from those who've actually made a mistake, even if it was a single occurrence. We're taking the lives away from young men who really do not understand what it is that they've done.
As a person who was sexually abused for 5 years, Coletta says she understands the intent behind the bill. But she says legislation driven by emotion, not research, is irresponsible. For example, research shows child pornographers are at a lower risk for reoffending than actual sex offenders and would be better suited towards rehabilitation. And South Florida forensic psychologist Eric Imhoff agrees. A specialist in sex offenders for 20 years, he says lawmakers are jumping the gun and lumping all sex offenders together before doing the research.
The current research shows that there's no bearing of the number of images on the risk that an individual poses. Research also is inconsistent and doesn't show that pornography leads to commission of hands-on offenses or more sexual violence. We have tools that will help us sort out who is high risk and low risk, and I don't think at this point in time these tools are being used effectively.
Many lawmakers on the panel still said they supported the bill, but after hearing some of the testimony, Democratic Representative John Julian of North Miami Beach says one area was a concern for him.
I'm a parent of five, and one of the last things that I would ever want is to see an image of my child in child pornography. I am, however, concerned. We would penalize the person who possesses the offensive material more than the person who manufactures, who creates, and distributes the material.
But Eisnagel, who was sure his bill would move quickly through committee, says he does not understand where all these concerns are coming from. He says all his bill is about is giving the victims a fair shake in bringing child pornographers to justice.
Child pornographers use technology to put them all into one file so that they can have thousands of victims, but only one charge. If we stand by up here and we allow that, well, frankly, I don't know how I go home and see my two kids.
The bill passed favorably among members of the House Judiciary Committee with only one dissenting vote in Democratic Representative Elaine Schwartz of Hollywood. But some supporters of the bill still had concerns that they hope to work out with Eisnagel. The bill now heads to the House floor. Its Senate companion, Senate Bill 964, is in its second committee stop. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tramell Gomes, inviting you to join us each weeknight for more reports from the state capitol.